I'd like to first introduce Alicia Jackson, who has been instrumental in helping us to bring all of you together here today. Alicia works in the Senate Energy Committee, which has something to say about what will be happening in American energy policy. We're very pleased that she's with us today.
Thanks, Chuck. First, I want to start by just thanking DOE, particularly John, as well as the National Academies, led by Chuck, really. It's incredibly important that we get everyone in the room at the same time, and it's very rare to be able to do this, especially right now when there's a real sense of urgency in the Congress to make sure that we don't let this opportunity pass us by, this opportunity to not only lead in research, development, but also in manufacturing. My boss particularly, Jeff Bingaman, is very concerned about this. He played a role in Semitech, and I think he sees something similar being possible with photovoltaics and clean energy in general. It's every day there's someone in our office telling us, can you believe what China's doing? I was just there. Can you believe what Japan's doing? I was just there. And so there's definitely a concern. And so we're really looking forward to the insights and recommendations that come out of these series of workshops. So with that, we're particularly honored to have Dr. Christina Johnson, the Undersecretary at the Department of Energy, here with us today. She's already had a very distinguished career. Previous to this, she was the Provost and Senior Vice President of Academic Affairs at Johns Hopkins. And we're very lucky as a country to have someone of her caliber in the Department of Energy. And with that, I'll let her start.
Thank you very much, Alicia. I have a few slides because I would like to illustrate a couple concepts about what we're doing in the Department of Energy and how all these new initiatives fit together. That's been something that we've asked about. So as long as I was going to have a few, I decided to have just a few. So if I could go to the next slide. Thank you very much. Well, just to review, I always want to start out with what the President's goals are. And as we know, the goals broadly are, of course, about the economy, about energy, and about health care. So today, the three that we are looking at and looking at road mapping, which I'll get through in a few minutes, are how do we get to reducing the greenhouse gas emissions by 83% by 2005? How do we conserve 3.6 million barrels of oil a day within 10 years? And then how do we build a world-class workforce in a sustainable green economy? And I think this is where my background in academia, I'm very passionate about how do we educate the workforce, not only to reflect the demographics, but reflect the needs that we have for energy in the future. So, you know, there have been a lot of talks, predictions about jobs, and we're going to say a few words about that. But I think one of the ones I read last night was from the Gigaton Throwdown by Dan Kamen. And it's roughly, if it was all solar, very roughly, order of magnitude, which means, you know, from 0.3 to 1 on the logarithmic scale, you know, it's something like 3 to 10 jobs per megawatt, right? So if you think about how many gigawatts we're going to replace with renewables, you know, you're looking at if we need to get to this greenhouse gas reduction, and we're going to replace that with renewables and baseload, including nuclear, hydro, clean coal, talking about turning over probably 3 to 10 million jobs. So the question is, where are those jobs going to be? If I could have the next slide, that would be great. So I'm going to focus on, thank you, of the how, which is how are we going to do this, in particular in the Department of Energy. Science and engineering is informing policy. Policy will promote change in technology adoption. And what we are focused on is coming up with a framework that will integrate energy policy, science, and technology goals in an energy technology roadmap. So this roadmap will have quantitative goals. It'll have on-ramps and off-ramps as we find technologies that can get us to carrying out the President's objectives. And so there are a number of very interesting roadmaps. What we plan to do is put them all into, if you will, the same units, So we're going to do a unit analysis on a meta-analysis on the roadmaps that are out there. That's one. The second thing is many of the roadmaps are not integrated. So they'll give you an estimate on where solar will be by turning off all of the other sources of energy. They'll give you an estimate of where energy efficiency would be, say, in buildings, without taking into account that maybe there is some overlap in the way we count the efficiency. For example, if we go to ground source heat pump systems, are we double counting both the efficiency as well as the source if we just add them up of the energy that's generated from geothermal? So what we plan to do is get this all on one map, have the assumptions be peer-reviewed and understood, and then plot a direction that will help guide our investments in R&D technology in order to achieve those goals. So that's one of my very first initiatives personally as Undersecretary. The second thing is as a it's interesting that the two undersecretaries in the Department of Energy are former provosts. My great colleague Steve Koonin was provost at Caltech, and I was provost at Johns Hopkins. And I'd like to think that was not by mistake, but I think that one of the things that we are really working on is coordinating R&D across basic sciences and energy areas, and including NNSA. So I'm going to say a few more words about that. So that's a second priority for us. And the third one is to look at carrying out these initiatives that do cut across the department and, in fact, interagencies. So big push in this administration to work across agencies and work across stovepipes, not just within the department but also within the agencies. So I go to the next slide. Thank you. Some of the new initiatives which have occupied us for a while, of course, is the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. It's about $26 billion for DOE programs. And with part of those funds, we stood up 46 Energy Frontier Centers. We started ARPA-E. We are working on energy hubs, and that's in process right now and being considered by the Senate and the House, of course, and also re-energize. And so what we're trying to do is make sure as we invest in the kind of technologies that will be required to meet the goals and to create a green economy in this century and in the next few decades, are we going to have the workforce? So here's a statistic that I was not aware of, but the Center for Energy Workforce Development, CEWD, said that 60% of their workers will retire in the next 5 years. And these are great paying jobs. And so this is a real national crisis. So re-energize, the motivation by re-energize is to see that not only does the industry evolve in the way we want, but that we have an educated workforce that can step into those jobs here in the country. My background is in photonics. I was very heavily involved in the 90s, late 80s and 90s in trying to develop components for the telecommunication display industry. And we had a big problem, especially in the display industry, trying to find educated workforce that could. And a lot of us started little companies in Boulder and became a sort of display hub in this country, if you will. And we ended up stealing each other's students. When they graduated, stealing each other's students as employees. And that just isn't a very productive way to build an industry. So we have to make sure that we invest in the kind of curriculum, both at the community college as well as at the four-year and advanced school, so that we can educate the workforce. Let me go to the next slide. This is the reason that inspired going to PowerPoint, and forgive me, but I didn't know any better way of doing it, maybe building blocks I could have done. But you know, so if we think about it, I'm sure many of you have read or known of Donald Stokes' book, Past Year's Quadrant. So if we think about applying it to DOE and to say, why are we starting energy frontier research centers and ARPA-E and hubs and re-energize, and how does this all fit together? Well, in Past Year's Quadrant, you have fundamental research on the y-axis and applied on the x-axis. And you might think traditionally that academic labs were on the more fundamental and less applied side, although I'm an engineer, so I might say that, you know, obviously it's also implied. Then in the upper right-hand quadrant, whether it's a 2x2 BCG quadrant or past year's quadrant, that's kind of where you want to be, right? Use-inspired. So you do research that's informed by consideration of how it will be used in the future. And then you might think that industry and labs traditionally have taken the role of thinking about applied and getting it closer to tech transfer. Many things have happened on the way to get to this point that started maybe back after the 50s with Vannevar Bush's view of how one does research from basic through applied. And I think that's worth saying a few words about, so I'm going to go to that in a couple minutes. But if we look now at all the DOE programs in the next slide, you can see that the real fundamental sort of put fundamental slash risk along the y-axis and applied slash commercial on the x-axis. So traditional basic science R&D would be the upper left-hand corner. Energy Frontier Research Centers are five-year centers to try and bring the basic research into prototypes, demos, looking for the next frontier of what could possibly be handed off to technology development and reinvestment. Now, these do overlap, so basic R&D is sort of blue, and when it overlaps with red and this projector, I could tell you a lot about the colors in projectors because I used to do that. They aren't quite faithful, but if they were, that would be a better shade of magenta. And then you have ARPA-E. So Engineering Frontier Research Centers, in a sense, are an overlap of basic research and looking for breakthroughs. They are basically 5 years, can be renewed for another 5 years. ARPA-E is much more thinking about very high risk, but also what could have a breakthrough impact in scale and applicability. And so if you think about basic research, might be something like the going back to the photoelectric effect, right? Oh, okay, so you know Einstein's one of his first papers, which is first reference in my thesis, is the photoelectric effect. You generate electron, photon comes in, right? So then you think about, okay, how do we take that to something that might be interesting and explore the physics more? Well, transistor technology came along. Now we can generate that. That might be done in an Engineering Frontier Research Center. Then you might say, well, it may only be a few percent efficient, or maybe 7-8% efficient if we implement it with the traditional solar PV panel system with, say, amorphous silicon. We want something that's going to be up towards, you know, 40-50%. Well, we do have solar technology that can generate those kind of efficiencies, but are they deployable in scale, and what's going to help us get there? And that's what ARPA-E is looking for, is the breakthrough that will accelerate the commercialization of technologies that can have a factor of 2, 5, or 10. We're not looking at 10% improvement or 20% improvement. We're looking for orders of magnitude improvement. Once those breakthroughs are developed, a hub is something where now you bring people together and you say, what does it take over a sustained period of time and at scale to actually deploy this technology so that actually you create the market? And that's really where the hubs come in. And once that's done, it is an overlap, again, it's in yellow, between ARPA-E and technology R&D and industry. And so when you think about this, it is an overlapping diagram. But we want to be in the upper left, upper right, lower right. We want to be things that are fundamentally high risk, but could have a big payoff in terms of impact and scale, and then we'll migrate that through overlapping platforms like the hub to bring people together to really create those new industries. And this is my vision of how these programs fit together. If I go to the next slide. Now, it's a little bit different than a one-dimensional or two-dimensional view of research. You know, you think about knowledge, science, and then goes to use technology. You know, that was the way it was, and that was the way that, that Vannevar Bush envisioned it. But a funny thing happened between the 50s and today. You know, the things that happened started out with the invention of the transistor. With the invention of the transistor, then came components and subsystems and computers, and now all of a sudden you had the information age. And when once you had the information age, what you did is you provided tools to engineers so that they could design more intelligently using models. So now all of a sudden merged research that usually was done by, say, scientists and then handed off to be built. So traditionally you think about a scientist thinks about how things work and an engineer makes things work. Now with the computer you actually have a platform to create the kind of tools that allow not only engineers but also social scientists to become more quantitative and take more analytical approaches to deployment of technology. This is I think a fundamental change that has not been clearly recognized. Second thing that happened was the Bayh-Dole Act. So when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, I had my first little invention. I brought it to Niels Reimer. If those of you have been in commercialization that long, remember Niels. He was the great tech transfer person at Stanford before Kathy Koo. He was one person in an assistant in a trailer park behind our freshman dorm. He said, you know, basically, in a very nice way, kid, get out of my office. We don't do toys. Then the Bayh-Dole Act happened, and I got a call back 2 or 3 years later. You know, we're kind of interested in that toy. Because what happened was is that legislation, and this is the push, or the nudge, if you will, of where government policy can change the way business is done, that says now universities have an obligation to commercialize their technology. And then you had the SBIR program started, where 2.8% of the R&D budget in the United States has to, federally funded R&D budget has to be applied to commercializing technology or involving small business in the research enterprise of those government agencies. So you had two other things that happened, and then when you think about them in the context of where we're going, we can't look at it just in a point in time. We have to look at where we are going in the future, and that's where the PV world comes in, which we'll get to in a minute if I go to the next slide. So really what we see that today, from the inspiration of Vannevar Bush to have an R&D, vibrant R&D enterprise, which has been the envy of the world, is really more of a two-dimensional view, where in Pasteur's quadrant, Bohr would be up in the left-hand corner thinking about the fundamental properties of the atom, but not maybe how it would be used. To Edison, traditionally the engineer, inventor, who didn't care how things worked, I'm overstating it, of course, but that things did work. And then, you know, the upper right-hand corner, we've had examples of individuals over time that were did fundamental work with use and inspiration. So you had Pasteur, who invented microbiology, but he was interested in how do you solve problems of creating vaccines for disease. You had Turing and Shannon, who thought about very fundamental properties of how you develop a state machine or information theory, but that gave rise to the computer revolution. Madame Curie, as we know, won a Nobel Prize for some fundamental discoveries in physics, but she was the first with John Joly to apply radium to the treatment of cancer. I actually am a happily living today because of that fundamental work in the 1900s. I had Hodgkin's disease, and by an engineer and a physicist working together with a medical physician, they were able to come up with a medical linear accelerator that fit inside a room that would actually kill the Reed-Sternberg cells that I had in Hodgkin's. So I am definitely a product of and a big fan of cross-disciplinary, use-inspired research. If I go to the next slide. So how do we apply this to the renewable energy technologies and the importance of PV? Well, if we look at this graph, what you'll see is a sort of interesting trend. I am an optical physicist, but I obviously have not kept a laser pointer batteries with me. Very important battery technology for renewables as well. But if we look up there and we see how the coal is increasing over time, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Here's renewables, right? And so now we look at this gap. We say, well, what is going to happen out here in 2010, 2030, 2040, if I could go to the next slide. We look at energy flow in BTUs. This is about 100, so these numbers here are coal at 22%, natural gas at 23%, petroleum at 39%, nuclear power at about 8.4%, and then you can see renewables energies, and it's so small, I can't actually read that. I've gotten old, but I think it's less than, say, a few percent if you don't include hydro. We have a long way to go from here to go up to there, which is where we're going in the future, if I could have the next slide. Let me skip over this just in the interest of time and go to the next slide. So we're here today to think about a number of different renewable energies sources. In particular, though, we're going to focus on solar. And if we go to the next slide, what are we doing in solar? Well, of these Energy Frontier Research Centers, of the 46 awarded in 2009, John, I think you told me, was six involved solar technology, roughly? So that's a big push forward. ARPA-E, we received, as you may know, 3,500 white papers, and I think solar was one of the largest categories. Did the announcement get made today or yesterday? Not yet.
I don't believe so.
We're ready to announce the pre-selected that we're going to invite a group of people, a group of proposals to come into full awards. That should be announced any day. And that was a great process. It was, and I want to thank anybody here that signed up to a reviewer. We sent out a letter inviting people to review, and it was a very intense process, but it was a very high-quality peer review process, so we're very happy about that. $117 million has been added to the Solar Energy Technology Program, and we're making announcements in advanced batteries and electric vehicles, which, of course, could also integrate and solar, looking at modernization of the grid with billions. And I want to end with what I'm saying with this note here, which is the SBIR-STTR program. With the Recovery Act, any of the R&D that we do within the Recovery Act is still subject to the 2.8% being applied towards commercialization. So that was about $55 million. And working with my colleague Carol and others within the EERE program, the FE program, the OE program, and these are all acronyms. I'm sorry, talking acronyms. I guess I have become government. We are taking about $40 million of that, and we have actually applied for and have our request has been granted to take 50% as the criteria in awarding these grants towards commercialization and job creation. And we very much want to encourage, when that solicitation will come out within the next week, individuals in the PV area and in a lot of the renewable areas to apply for that funding. And this is something that we will be monitoring, tracking, and seeing if we can improve the support in the renewable areas and continue to create jobs in new industries. If I could have the next slide. I think you all know this. We're expecting solar to provide 6% by 2030, almost evenly split between photovoltaic and concentrated solar. And if I could move to the next slide. Let me go to the next slide just in the interest of moving along. Of course, there are some barriers to achieving the renewable target. So I asked the question, you know, will solar achieve 5 cents a kilowatt hour by 2020, and is that necessary for mass deployment? If I go to the next slide. So some of the as you know, there are very progressive areas. I used to live in one, not that I don't live in one now, I do, but in Boulder. They have a program called Climate Smart. And any if you weatherize your home and do some other things, which I think include mounting solar panels on the roof, you can actually wrap the cost of that into your property taxes over a 15-year period of time. I'm going to go to a workshop when I'm back in August on vacation and learn about how to do this, so I'll have more information. But there's also a very they've also been able to take advantage of the federal tax credit as well as an Xcel Energy rebate of $3.50 per watt. So I think that these are the kind of nudges that get people to kind of stand up and take notice. I mean, we had a conversation right before this, and I'll conclude a little bit by just, I wanted to say a word about energy hubs, and then I'll conclude. So if we skip ahead to a couple slides, but just end on this slide. We had a conversation on the way over here. What does it take to get people who to think beyond just their current bill, you know, their monthly bill, to think, okay, if I put in this investment, then I'm going to reap this benefit for many years. And it's clear that it's just the barrier to entry is just their initial capital cost. And so, you know, what we can do is to try and nudge along the opportunities for people to save money over the long period of time. I want to end on just the energy hubs and why this is so important. This is the Secretary's number one priority. And the reason why is that we have seen an awful lot of individuals coming together, working under mainly one roof on topics and making incredible breakthroughs, whether it's a transistor that launched the information age or disease-resistant agricultural engineering or the ARPANET internet. When you get a bunch of talented individuals working together across disciplines under one roof, they're rubbing elbows constantly and thinking only about one thing, you have tremendous breakthroughs. In fact, it's in the DNA of the DOE, started with the Manhattan Project. So we recognize that there are breakthroughs for direct fuels from sunlight. Plants do it pretty well, artificial photosynthesis, but not at high efficiency. So can we be inspired by evolution and Mother Nature and to apply our quantitative tools and analytical approaches to do it in a more timely manner than millions of years? Electricity from sunlight, energy storage, grid modernization, efficient building systems. 40% of the energy in this country, as you know, is in commercial and residential buildings. Extreme materials, because 97% of the energy in this country right now is from turbine systems that are governed by the Carnot cycle, and the higher the temperature differential, the more efficiency you get. So materials that can withstand temperatures of over 1,000 degrees C. Modeling and simulation will be a big thrust, and this is where we can draw on what's known in both science and NNSA. And then finally, carbon capture and sequestration. So I guess I would just conclude by saying it's a very exciting time. We're thrilled to be here, to be your partner, and to help continue the PV revolution. Thank you.
I'll stay here if you're willing to work slides still, Adam. I appreciate that. So I'm John Leschetsky. I am currently the Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy Efficiency. That's my day job. My previous job, and maybe my evening and weekend job, is continuing to have a very strong interest in the solar program, having managed the SETP for approximately 8 months before coming in this current position. So continue to be very, very interested in this topic and was, I think, one of the originators or instigators with Chuck Wessner in terms of this forum. I would like to very much thank Chuck and the National Academies of Sciences for the work they've done in organizing these workshops. As Undersecretary Johnson said, we are innovators over at the Department of Energy. In this case, I think we are innovating in terms of the clock speed that we asked our partners to work at. We feel that this is a very important topic and one that that we can work through very, very quickly, and we appreciate the National Academies in supporting us in that schedule and having these workshops and helping us reach an informed and very rational decision in a timely way. So with that, I'll go ahead and go. What I'm going to do is just give you a very quick overview of the program, because obviously in terms of considering what the options are for partnerships, for DOE, for any other part of the industry, it's helpful to know where we are right now in terms of a program. So I will do that very quickly. Some of this I know is review to some of you, but hopefully it'll be informative and show you some of this in a slightly different light. The program right now is very much focused on a 2015 goal of getting to grid parity. Now, grid parity, obviously, for those of you in the industry, is a slightly slippery concept. It depends on a number of different things, as has been pointed out, in terms of financing terms, local solar conditions. But in a general sense, trying to get to widespread geographic grid parity by 2015, and then you see the specific LCOE targets that we are driving to in terms of both residential, commercial, and utility scale solar to make that happen. If you go to the next slide, you'll see that based on historical learning curves and where we project the industry to be, and given this is dollars per watt for just module prices, obviously the previous chart was cents per kilowatt hour on a system level. This doesn't tell the whole story, but things are, and I think it's already been recognized in the presentations done here today, that we have, if we're not there, then we have line of sight to the goal of grid parity, at least a grid parity for peaking rates for a large portion of the U.S. In the 2015 timeframe. That doesn't mean there's no work to be done. That doesn't mean that we will not continue to be investing in a number of programs that we have been working on. But in terms of looking out in a large government program, it's somewhat akin to steering a battleship or a tanker sometimes. So looking out 5 years and starting to plan your moves over the next 2 or 3 years, I think, is a reasonable thing to do. And that's really, I think, the process or the framework that we're operating in right now. So if you could go to the next slide, please. So let me give you some backdrop. The program itself is really organized into these four different components. PV is a prime and historically large part of the program and will continue to be a large part of the program. CSP, the concentrating solar portion, is also a growing portion of the program now. And then the two pieces that really look at deployment in terms of market transformation and grid integration, really looking at some of the things that were talked about this morning in terms of the permitting processes, the market acceptance processes, which I think was highlighted, or at least as significant as some of the cost and other technical issues that the industry needs to address. And then the grid integration issues. How do these systems look when they're deployed in large scale on the grid? How do they behave? How do they work with energy storage? All these different things. So the rest of my remarks are going to really focus on PV, but I just wanted to give you that background. So next slide, please. This gives you a sense of the budget history of the program. A large step up in FY07 in response to the administration's Solar America initiative, and a large step up in FY09 to the Recovery Act funding, $51.5 million of which was devoted to PV, and then a significant request in FY10 that stretches across all different four components of the program. Next slide, please. This gives you a breakdown based on the '09 dollars, how we spend that money. Again, PV, a significant part of that.
by recipient, really split directly between going directly to industry to investing through the national labs. A portion there, you see 5% going into universities, and it has been mentioned in several different instances, and we are taking this observation very seriously about ways to further increase university involvement, looking at that in terms of workforce development as well as investment in long-term research. And then by term, we have been by nature very much focused on near-term deployment, and we're defining that as less than 7 years, but as you'll see, a significant portion still going to longer-term R&D. Next slide. This shows you sort of the different components of the program, stretching from early-stage research, where we work closely with our colleagues at Office of Science, all the way to working in market transformation, really looking at codes and standards, outreach to utilities, all those sorts of things that really need to happen for large-scale deployment, and all the things in the middle. I'm just going to focus, if you could just advance one slide, on sort of these different pieces, which are really all feeding PV-specific and really looking at, except for one exception, really looking at near-term commercialization. So next slide, please. Just to mention about the recovery funding, a significant amount went into PV. That was divided into $22 million for supply chain, and I'm going to talk about that in more detail. The pre-incubator projects were also announced. I'm going to talk about that and incubators, the next piece there, and then also a significant amount of funding for high-penetration solar development and grid integration and market transformation as well. Next slide. So, the thing I want to say, I think, at the beginning is early stage research continues to be a large, certainly a large focus of the program. Even though it's 10%, we continue to realize that priming the pump, making sure that there is a robust R&D pipeline is very important to the program. We also, though, look at partnering with Basic Energy Sciences and the work that they're doing. This represents our next-gen program, and it shows you really the diversity of technologies that we're investing in, again, in partnership with BES, a lot of university research there. Obviously, I think in most cases, these are technologies that are post-2015. In terms of when they will be ready for the market. They obviously represent potential significant advances, but again, these are things that are out beyond our 2015 goals. We'll continue and invest in these, and in fact, with some of the recovery money, are looking at some lab calls that will continue to populate the pipeline at the early stages. So I don't want any of my remarks to be misinterpreted to say that we're not doing that, though the rest of my remarks will focus on the later stage work. Next slide, please. So there really are three key components, and then one other that I want to talk about: technology pathway partnerships that were mentioned this morning, PV technology incubators, and then supply chain and cross-cutting technologies. And if we could go to the next slide, I'll talk about that in more detail. And this was mentioned by United Solar. This was really a program 3 years ago that really tried to get the industry to focus and collaborate to drive down systems cost in dollars per kilowatt hour. Previously, a lot of the industry was focused, as we've noted, on efficiencies of cells, and certainly that's an important part to driving costs down, but not the only solution. So what we did was put out a solicitation that said, bring teams, bring large systems teams, everything from silicon manufacturers to roofers across the board and everything in between, and really get people collaborating. Obviously, in a mature industry, you don't need to do that, and I think at this point, maybe a lot of the objectives of the TPPs have been satisfied, are largely achieved. We're continuing to look at that program to see if that is the right structure of program going forward, given how the industry has matured very, very rapidly over the last 3 years. No decisions have been made, but that is something that I think we're reviewing to understand if that is the most appropriate response for the industry. But that clearly, I think, and many of you have told us this, this was a key element in getting the industry to move forward and focus on system costs, and we certainly count that, I think, as one of our contributions to helping the industry. Next slide. Something that we have done more recently is look at incubators. This is a generic term, and the way we mean it is really helping early-stage companies to get out of proof of principle and to ramp up to initial low levels of production, and doing this by working very, very closely with National Renewable Energy Lab and leveraging the expertise in the lab as well as other labs, but really trying to get out of the lab into production on the order of 3 megawatts. This particular picture here is from Abound Solar, previously AVA Solar in Colorado. There's a number of other companies represented there. We have done both two rounds of this. You can see on the right-hand side the second round projects and the companies there, and then the first round projects and we're coming up with another round here that should be awarded here very, very soon. But again, focusing on commercialization, focusing on how do we get these companies into manufacturing and get them up and running and beginning the scale process. Next slide, please. And then a different take is really saying not investing in what the next best cell technology is, but looking at the cell technologies that are out there and say, how do we invest in supply chain technologies that have the opportunity to leverage across a whole sector of the industry? So whether it's in new methods of silicon supply, new types of substrates, new types of encapsulants, so things that really can leverage across a whole industry and really drive costs that way than saying, all right, we're going to come up with the next best, latest cell technology or module technology. Really look at a leverage point, a roadblock that really unlocks cost and increases productivity in the industry. Next slide, please. So I want to talk very quickly about the labs. Obviously, the labs, as I said, got almost 50% of our investment. A lot of our PV technology has been through NREL historically, though we also work very closely with Sandia. We also have had very good conversations with other labs, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, Argonne National Lab, Oak Ridge National Lab, just to name a couple. You know, PV technology obviously is research is being done in a number of different areas within the National Lab System. One of the initiatives that we launched with recovery funding was putting out a lab call to all the different DOE labs. So I would encourage you, if you have been working with one or two particular labs, that you also explore other relationships, and we're certainly open to bringing the best and brightest ideas forward, either in research or in commercialization. Next slide. But one thing I do want to talk about, specifically that we've invested in NREL, is the PDIL, the Process Development Innovation Lab. This is not manufacturing, though I think sometimes it may get confused that way. This is R&D on a manufacturing level scale. In fact, it's not manufacturing. All this equipment is very specialized. It's not off-the-shelf equipment for the most part. But it allows the scientists at NREL to partner with industry in developing processes in an environment that then is easily transferable to a manufacturing environment. So you're working on a manufacturing level wafer sizes. You have good process control to look at different coatings, different deposition levels, or different deposition layers. So you have a large amount of flexibility, a large amount of control. The flexibility obviously does not lend itself to manufacturing, but it allows you to look at different processes, baseline them, and then if things are working properly, and we have the necessary metrology equipment there to support this as well, that then it is more easily transferable to a production environment. So as the graphic up there on the right-hand side says or shows you, this kind of bridges what we saw as a gap between the pure R&D, small-scale, 1 or 2 centimeter type samples that NREL was working on and what industry obviously needed. Now, we still see potential needs for additional resources there, but certainly this we think is a key resource, and we welcome inquiries or interest on industry's level from industry to partner with NREL in working on your technologies and working on innovations there in that environment. Next slide. So just one thought to kind of leave you with, and this is kind of frames some of our thinking. I think it was already talked about, the market is largely outside the U.S. In terms of demand. The supply base is outside of the U.S. in terms of manufacturing. But the innovation base, I think, is clearly in the United States. This chart shows you early stage venture capital and private equity investments through 2007, and my guess is the 2008 data would not show you significant difference. But looking at it from a technology level, looking at different technologies, clearly I think a lot that's been going on in Asia has been crystalline silicon, a little bit of I don't know if that's thin film, probably amorphous silicon, a little bit more diversity in the EU. But clearly in the US, we have a very robust venture capital and private equity base that has been funding a number of different technologies. And I think this is mirrored in the technology investments that DOE has been making as well through our TPP program, as well as our incubator and pre-incubator program. So we clearly have an opportunity here from DOE's standpoint to capture the next generation of technologies. And that certainly is driving a lot of our thinking in terms of forums like this and discussions like this going forward. It's not the only consideration, but certainly I think is an important one as we have this discussion. So with that, hopefully I've come in under time. As the Deputy Assistant Secretary, one of the benefits is I get to give the program managers contact information. So if you have any questions, Joanne Milliken here, who is the acting program manager for the solar program, is here. That is her contact information. But feel free to contact either one of us if you have follow-up questions at this point or afterwards. So thank you all very much.
I recognize that we're a bit behind time, so I will try to move fairly smartly through this material. But what I wanted to share a bit of information with you about is it's less solar specific, but it is commercialization specific. So there's a fairly new team inside DOE in energy efficiency, renewable energy, that's just about commercializing technology, and it's technology agnostic. So it's really trying to look at things that work across technologies and that work for all technologies. But I'd like to try and pull out a few of those things that might be particularly relevant to the solar industry. So can I see the first slide, or should I just move them here? All right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this new commercialization group and focus on some of the things that are relevant to solar. So while we're working on a number of things that are about connecting investors to technologies and filling the funding gap in the Valley of Death, I will skip some of the things like the SBIR program, which Christina already talked about, as well as some of the things that we're doing, giving loans for advanced vehicles technologies, which is certainly a lot less relevant to you. The other thing that I thought was interesting from our last panel, which was the comment about how does the government provide assistance on commercialization and yet not get into the business of picking winners. So I think that we're walking that that line fairly well, but that would certainly be interesting to hear back from people about their perception on do these look like these are programs picking winners. So I think I'll talk about some of the programs as we go. One of them in particular is about the funding gap in the Valley of Death. So it's really looking at how do we put some funding in. One of the main things that we heard from the national labs, and this really is about commercializing national lab technologies, one of the things that we hear from the labs is that there really is a gap, and it's missing this later stage funding. So a lot of funding going into the national labs, billions of dollars over decades on research, much less going into the commercialization area. So in conversations with our national labs, when we talk about, you know, what is needed, what's stopping commercialization, we hear a lot about the Valley of Death gap. And so we have put now about $14 million over the last 2 years into technologies in 10 of our labs, and we have a fairly loose criteria. Again, this is we're trying not to pick the winners, but it is about lab technologies, and then we want to see that there's market interest. So we ask for a 50-50 cost sharing with an industry partner. It both leverages the government's money, but it is more importantly an indicator for us that this is something that there is market interest in. And as you'll see from the pie chart, the majority, the largest recipient technology of this funding so far has been solar. Ampulse is one of the companies that got funding so far, and I probably have a list of the rest of them if that's of interest to people. Another set of programs, so that was about the funding gap. The other main part of our program is how do you get more eyes on the technologies? How do you really connect the investors and the entrepreneurs with the technologies that are in the national labs? And so we've started up a number of programs. This is one of them, the Entrepreneur in Residence program, which says, this is not the only way, but this is one way that we're looking at it. At, say, take an entrepreneur and they spend a year in the national lab, so basically mining, combing through all the technology that's available in the lab. They don't get exclusive rights to the labs. They just get better access, and they commit to looking preferentially at lab technologies to commercialize. One of the things I think the DOE wisely recognized is that they don't really have skills in choosing entrepreneurs. They don't know who the best entrepreneurs are or where to find them. So we partnered with venture capitalist firms, which have a much better track record of knowing who good entrepreneurs are. So the DOE partnership is actually with the VC firms who then find an entrepreneur to spend a year in the lab. One of the other things that we have learned, so we did this a year in three labs. We've completed that recently, and we're beginning now to start up a next round with four more labs. But one of the important things in our program on commercialization and deployment in general is we're trying to learn. We're trying to test a number of things and learn from them. And one of the things that we learned from this first round of Entrepreneur in Residence experiences was that maybe linking it to the model where it's one entrepreneur, one lab, and one VC doesn't give enough exposure to the entrepreneur when he's got an idea to pitch for he wants to do a startup and get funding. So we're now in the second round testing a couple ways to have that entrepreneur still work with one lab but have access to multiple VCs to pitch his technology to, which is a bit more real world anyway. You don't normally get locked into to one venture capitalist. So again, kind of cycling through, trying to learn from this and see how this works out. Again, on the theme of how to connect investors with technology, the Entrepreneur in Residence program is one example where you take all the technologies in one lab, work for the time horizon of 1 year with the one entrepreneur. Another kind of connecting people together is more of a speed dating kind of mechanism, whereas we have 2 days. We invite as many VCs or as willing to spend 2 days, and we plow through about 80-ish technologies with them over that time period. And again, it's less of an immersion and more of a here's a bunch of interesting technologies that we think that you should be aware that the labs are open for business. They've got a lot of interesting technologies. Wouldn't you like to commercialize some of these? And again, learning from this, one of the side benefits that was a bit unexpected for me was that in the process of getting these workshops together, these showcases and presentations, we did a lot of work with getting the scientists from the labs and the programs to put together a pitch on your best technologies. And we found that we were pretty good at doing presentations to defend budgets to Congress, not as good on doing presentations to pitch technologies to investors. So one of the side benefits that we got out of this is we've been coaching and training the scientists on how do you write up the technology summaries that are much more about what are the benefits of your technologies compared to its competitors? How do you entice investors to be interested and see that there's a market for this? So, again, kind of learning and then taking those learnings and moving on to the next step. And the program that I'm probably the most excited to talk about with you and with others is the Energy Efficiency Renewable Energy Technology Portal that we're working on. I joined the DOE about a year ago from industry, so I'm fairly new to the government, but I was pretty surprised to find out that there wasn't one-stop shopping for the great technologies that the taxpayers have been investing in. And if you want to know something about wind technologies, well, you better go to Sandia's site and then NREL's site and then another national lab site. And good luck if you can find something more than the patent application, which isn't really a great marketing document. So we're looking at a way to get all of the technologies that the DOE has invested in on clean technologies onto one portal so that you can look at it all together, and also kind of repeating that process that I talked about that we learned in the technology showcases. We don't even have great marketing documents written for all of our technologies, and so we're also through this process writing up great two-page technology summaries on what are all the benefits of the technology to help market them. So we think this is going to be live. We've got a demo site up already, but we think that this will be live early in the new year. So we're pretty excited about how to share the technologies. And again, you know, some learnings in this for the solar technologies, but in general, we're looking at how do you commercialize technologies in general? And part of being able to explain the benefits of your technologies over another technologies and being able to get enough venture capitalists in one place to get interested in investing are some of the things I hope you can take out of what we're learning through this. For the sake of time, I'll skip this. It's just kind of explaining how the program evolves. The other thing that I think should be of interest to you is some new Recovery Act funding that is coming. And this one might not be on everyone's radar screen to the same extent some of the other big programs are, like the grants in lieu of ITC, PTC. But this is a Recovery Act program that is all about renewables technologies, but it's actually administered through the IRS. So it doesn't even show up on DOE's radar screen always. But it's called, we like to have little numbers to attach to everything because we can't be bothered to say the Renewables Manufacturing Tax Credit. But this is 48C in the tax code. It's been funded for $2.3 billion in tax credits, a 30% tax credit. So it should fund $7.7 billion of manufacturing investments. So while we've been doing a decent job, and I think the solar industry might disagree that it's been a decent job, but we have, when the government focuses on incentivizing solar, it's been working much more on the deployment of solar and not so much on getting domestic manufacturing. So this is a program in particular targeted at domestic manufacturing for all the energy efficiency and renewables technology. So part of the complexity is we're going to need to be able to evaluate energy efficiency manufacturing plants for, you know, energy efficient windows compared to solar PV plants. But there is $2.3 billion, and perhaps the real important takeaway from this is it's coming sooner than you're probably expecting. And again, it doesn't seem to be on radar screens to the same extent of other programs, but because it's run out of the IRS has much more expedited processes on rulemaking and solicitations than the DOE seems to have, and it's mandated to come out 180 days after the Recovery Act passed, which if you add that up on the calendar, it's mid-August. And that is not only when the information is going to come out, but when the solicitation will open. So stay tuned for that. That was kind of a whirlwind tour of what's going on in the department, in EERE in general, on commercialization in general. There are some things in there that are quite specific and relevant to solar, but I think you should also be able to take away some of the general learnings about commercializing technologies and private-public partnerships, which we work on. Thanks.
Shubhendu Guha from United Solar Funding. I would like to understand the DOE's view in terms of evolution and revolution. As we talked about this morning, the industries have done a phenomenal job in reducing the cost, system cost, PV cost, and we are not there yet. And many of us have done it through the support that we have received from DOE. I'm a little concerned that these days we hear mostly about revolution, thinking out of the box. I just want to assure you that the way we have reduced the cost is not just turning of the knobs. There has been a lot of smart work that has gone in. And I'm worried that we'll spend time in developing a technology which will always remain the technology of future.
So my personal opinion is I don't think it's an either-or question. I think that as we've been able to show, and if you look at our program combined with the Office of Science program, I mean, I think the DOE position has been that both need to be funded and funded significantly. But certainly, so Carol mentioned that she just came into DOE. I've only been in DOE for a year, having spent all my career outside of government. So I can certainly appreciate all the comments that were made here today about needing incremental improvement and how much investment that takes, how much time that takes, but that also that in time and with resources that significant gains can be made in these technologies, and that we can't really predict when they might flatten out. I mean, people were predicting the end of different technologies over history and have always been wrong. So it's not an either-or question. I think from my standpoint, or I think if you look at the department's standpoint in terms of the funding profiles that have gone into basic and applied research, there certainly has been a lot of talk and a lot of attention given to the early stage work. But if you also pay very close attention to Undersecretary Johnson's comments, a lot of the thrust has been on bridging any perceived gap between basic and applied. So with the hubs and some of the other initiatives, that's really, I think, where a lot of the emphasis is. Okay?
Hi. Following up on your comment about the maturing industry in the United States and around the world, what role do you think the Department of Energy can play in a national procurement system in the sense of getting out there and actually buying up these emerging technologies that exist today? I referenced the cost curve improvements over 5 years at First Solar that we heard about on the first panel, just simply by, I said, turning the handle. If we buy $26 billion worth of PV and put them on every single government installation, how much do you think that could drive down, the cost of producing these technologies as opposed to, some of the programs which seem worthy and are fantastic? But it seems like with the maturing of the industry, there's got to be a little bit of a balance to be struck in that area.
So again, it's not an either or. I mean, I think if you look at the grants in lieu of tax credits is uncapped, and so from an appropriation standpoint, they've modeled it different ways. But certainly, my guess is, and that's in the tens of billions, if not hundreds, approaching $100 billion, when all is said and done. So that certainly represents a government investment in solar and renewable energy technologies. And the manufacturing tax credit, while it is capped, is a similar argument there. So again, I think you're seeing, we can all debate, more here, less there. But again, I think if your argument is that it really is a binary decision. I think the position is right now that both approaches are being pursued.
And I don't have the numbers memorized. John might know more about it, but there are also targets within the government for a certain amount of renewables. Yeah. It's not prescribed by particular technologies. There is some effort there, but I think recognizing what government investment is and things like the grants in lieu of tax credits is a huge investment.
Hi, my name is BJ Stamber. I'm with Heliovolt Corporation. We're kind of a company that's bridged the Valley of Death, and I'd like to talk about an opportunity, I think, for you to take a lesson perhaps from the National Science Foundation's successful experience. In the case of particular of the PDIL that you identified, I think that one of the missing opportunities that you ought to think about taking advantage of is the opportunity to solve the fundamental problem that I find trying to bring a new technology really to market at scale, and that's really more about the manufacturing equipment supply chain. And I think you have an opportunity to seed that in the PDIL by borrowing from the NSF their practice of funding equipment for targeted the development for targeted experimental programs, tying both funding for developmental equipment with process development. And I think that kind of investment is an opportunity that's not quite in your portfolio adequately balanced at this point in time that I'd like to suggest you consider.
Yeah, I agree. It's not. And we could have a conversation of whether the PDIL is the best place for it, but I absolutely agree that there's a lot of merit having that discussion and how we would interact with tool suppliers and process development parts of the industry to make sure that is properly supported.
Thank you.
I'm going to take the moderator's privilege here and ask a follow-up question to that, which is Undersecretary Johnson talked a lot about breaking down barriers within the department as far as applied research versus basic research versus deployment goes. I wondered if you guys could speak a little bit regarding breaking down barriers between agencies, particularly with agencies such as NIST and DOD, which have these kind of manufacturing development expertise, and if you could talk about how you're interacting with those folks.
So we certainly have talked with our colleagues at NIST in terms of the programs that they are actively engaged in. I think there is a lot more upside in those discussions, and certainly on the topic of manufacturing and commercialization. We have not gone as far as I think we could. I think certainly as this dialogue progresses, that is a key part, I think, of this overall discussion. And then you said DOD? So DOD, I think, will, in terms of government deployment of renewables and energy efficiency, is, I think, DOE's biggest ally. Because they clearly have a very mission-critical need in terms of reducing energy use, reducing fuel supplies, and the logistics requirement that goes with those. Within DOE, part of the organization that I currently am responsible for is the Federal Energy Management Program. FEMP is the direct go-between DOE and various government agencies in helping them implement energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies. And I know there is a meeting this afternoon or tomorrow, I believe, with DOD and Pentagon. But no, I think that clearly is, and I think the rest of the industry also needs to recognize that you clearly have an agency within the government that can be a very early adopter. We can debate on what the volumes are going to be, but I think as was evidenced with DARPA's high-energy solar cell program, DOD is a great launching point in terms of new technologies, getting things out there, and then transitioning them to the wider commercial market. So I think I'm glad you brought both of those up. And DOD should not be overlooked, I think, in any of these discussions on commercialization.
And I would just give us two other examples for good interagency cooperation. It was a bit of a forced marriage on some of the Recovery Act funding that the grants in lieu of tax credits is actually money managed out of Treasury, and yet the technical expertise and the setup of the program needed to be designed within the Department of Energy. And similarly, for the manufacturing tax credit that I just talked about, the money is out of IRS and the technical expertise is out of DOE. And while it should be, and hopefully has been, kind of seamless and invisible to the public, getting those agencies to work together that quickly and still meet the deadlines on both of those programs is, I think, pretty remarkable.
Could I just, we actually desperately need to move to the next session, but I can't resist a question, if you'll apologize, a suggestion. The SBR program that was mentioned by the Undersecretary, Carol, it's quite interesting what you're talking about. And first, there are some interesting, where DOE has led the government in commercialization opportunities forum, where they bring in small companies that have responded to SBR solicitations. And you can also run that backwards. If you do solicitations that involve using technologies that you have in the labs, that can act as a catalyst for the licensing and adoption of those technologies. There also, as many people know, the program is only $100,000 in the beginning and $750,000, except when it's $3 million and $8 million. And the flexibility that is allowed of that program enables you to do, through established procedures with established constituencies, some very interesting things. We're talking about some of the battery work, and you know, the leading battery supplier for Chrysler is a company called A123 in Massachusetts, which is directly out of 2004 SBR awards. So the strength of the program that you already have at DOE could be an asset. But that said, and after my little speech, could I, with my apologies to our colleagues, I think we could talk to you all day, but and hope to in the afternoon. But could we move on to the next panel and perhaps have a round of applause for this one?